In 2016, filmmaker Matthew Ornstein was working on a documentary entitled Accidental Courtesy, Daryl Davis, Race, and America, which was featured on PBS's Independent Lens, and went on to win multiple awards on the festival circuit. The film followed its subject, a popular blues musician with an unusual hobby, as described in the synopsis, particularly for a middle-aged black man. This unusual hobby of befriending members of the Ku Klux Klan would probably better be described as a calling, one for which Davis has an extraordinary gift. Because the relationships he's managed to forge have had some truly remarkable effects on many of his new friends. One of those friends is Jeff Scoop, former leader of the National Socialist Movement, previously known as the American Nazi Party, which was formed by George Lincoln Rockwell in 1959. Despite various changes in name, leadership, and mission statement, the NSM has been designated a hate group by the Southern Poverty Law Center and is widely recognized as a white supremacist organization, the largest in America. It's still active today, though Scoop is not. Daryl Davis and Jeff Scoop first met in 2016, while filming for the documentary, when Scoop was still active in the movement. And today they'll be joining me to tell the story of their unlikely and transformative friendship, to discuss racial animus and other forms of hatred, and to share their incredible insights about hope for respect and reconciliation in America. They've learned a great deal from their time in the trenches. I'll spare you the long introductions, as my guests can provide them much better than I can. And they do. For Crawl Space Media and Light Upon Light, I'm Nama Cates. Welcome to Escape Hate. All right, so welcome to what will be the second episode of the Escape Hate podcast. If you can both introduce yourselves a little bit, we'll go alphabetically. Maybe Daryl, if you'd like.
Sure. My name is Daryl Davis. I'm age 61. I'm a professional musician born in Chicago. And as of the last 32, 33 years, I've been involved in meeting with white supremacists and black supremacists and trying to find some common ground to bring people together in harmony, because I find our society very divided.
Yeah, definitely is. Okay, Jeff?
Yeah, this is Jeff Scoop. I was former commander of the National Director of the National Socialist Movement for about 27 years, and I left the movement in March of 2019. Now I'm working to counter violent extremism here in America and abroad.
And you two know each other already. So when did you meet?
I met Jeff, I believe it was in 2016. Is that right, Jeff?
Yeah, I think so.
I was the subject of a documentary called Accidental Courtesy. And the producer and director had brought me down to Montgomery, Alabama, and different places in the U.S. And in Montgomery, they invited Jeff to come down from Detroit and have a conversation with me. And that's where we met.
Interesting. I'd like to hear more about that. The theme of this episode, it's more about wisdom and what you both have learned living the lives that you've lived. If you could talk about some of the reasons that both of you had for taking this path that you did, because I would call you both activists at this point. Would you say that's kind of a fair characterization?
Yeah, I mean, if that's what you want to call me, that's fine. I just think of myself as a humanitarian and a concerned citizen. But, you know, I've known about Jeff for, you know, for many years. I'd never met him, but, you know, I've seen him on different pieces of video and things like that, and was well aware of his position. I knew one of his high-ranking people in his movement. In fact, the guy lived near me here in Maryland, and he's in prison right now. But he lived here near me in Maryland, and I knew him before he got involved with the NSM, National Socialist Movement. He was an anarchist. At one point, he tried to run for county executive here in the county in which I live. That's where I met him. We even sat together at a protest of the police. We sat together and you know, told some jokes and stuff. And then, you know, a couple of years later, he came to a lecture of mine in Virginia. And at that point, he was involved with the NSM. He was polite and all that at the lecture. But then after the lecture was over, he emailed me and began, you know, trying to chew me a new one.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah, and so, you know, that was my introduction officially to the NSM. But, you know, that was just one individual. So, you know, when I heard of Jeff, you know, I wasn't sure, you know, how he would be. All I had to base it on was one of his people. But I arrived at the meeting place in Montgomery, Alabama, and Jeff was there with a friend of his sitting outside on a bench right outside the location. And I pulled up in a rental car, and I recognized him from having seen pictures of him. And I introduced myself. He was very polite, very cordial, and very friendly. And, you know, it kind of, you know, I was, you know, a little surprised. Mm. And, you know, we went on inside, and we got set up for the interview. And we had, I can speak for me, I can't speak for him, but I had a good time with him. And there was something about him that I liked. I didn't like his ideology, but I liked him. I liked the person. He was bright, he was witty, he was funny, and he was very cordial. And you know, we had a good conversation. And I saw the humanity in that. And that's what struck me as this person being somewhat different than what I expected, and it reinforced my own personal beliefs, you know, that you cannot judge a book by looking at the cover.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. And for me, when the producers of the program contacted me, normally I ask a lot of questions and I try to figure out, you know, what the program is about and who I'm meeting and all that sort of thing. And it's kind of an interesting story because for whatever reason, I didn't do that this particular time because I did not even know who Daryl was. So when I got there and I was sitting outside, one of the producers had approached us and said, "Do you know who Daryl Davis is?" And I said, "No, I don't." So I was not prepared at all. And they said, "Well, he's this black guy that meets with different Klan people and things like that." And I'm going into the interview automatically thinking, you know, I'm going to have to be on the defensive. A lot of times when you're in the movement, you have a different view of the world and you automatically think it's, you know, anything you're doing is going to be a hit piece or anything like that. And when I met Daryl, that whole perception, like this is going to be a debate, this is going to be nasty or all that sort of thing, all that just went away because he was so personable and kind. He found the commonalities. He's instantly disarming because he radiates good, positive energy. You know, he's a musician. I used to be a musician. And we talked about that. So right away, you know, we hit it off. He has a unique ability to reach people. And I think a lot of that is his just genuineness that shines through and reaches people. And that's really, truly a gift, I think.
Yeah, I think that one of the things that you, Daryl, do so well and kind of can speak about and embody is the ability to reach people, as individuals, and to get away from this idea that so many people seem to have now that we need to, the only way we have to communicate with each other is to attack and to kind of, you know, debate and win and really speak about commonalities. And I'm a musician too, so.
I want to correct one thing Jeff said. He said that he used to be a musician. I'll counter that. I'll say, man, once you're a musician, you're always a musician. You may not have played in a while, but you're still a musician.
Good point. Yeah,
that's true.
That is true, right? Very nice.
What did you play when you played, Jeff?
I was a singer.
Okay.
Yep. I actually, it's kind of funny because I sang in one of those hair bands. It was kind of like Motley Crue or you know, that style, that hair band type music. Nobody can picture that unless they've seen the pictures from back in the day. Nobody can picture it.
I played in Salt Lake City, Utah, back in the 80s on tour, and Motley Crue came out to see me.
Oh, wow. That's super cool.
That's cool.
Yeah, that and Tommy Lee.
Awesome.
You play piano, right?
I play piano mostly, some guitar, and I sing as well.
Yeah, me too.
All right. Well, we must be together.
Yes.
Awesome.
So going back in time a little bit, and you told me a little bit about this, but Jeff, you talked a bit about your path, your journey to becoming involved with that movement. And you said that it was for how many years? 20-something years?
Yeah, 27 total, yeah.
27 years. And Daryl, I believe you said that you've been speaking to people in racial supremacist groups for 30 years, right?
Yeah, I've been speaking for about 32, 33 years. But I actually, you know, began getting into it, gosh, probably 40 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
You're doing my research and trying to meet people and learn what, you know, what they were all about.
So with both of you, kind of, it goes back a while, but I would say that the paths you took are very different, obviously, you know, and now you've kind of ended up in a place that's more similar. Jeff, if you can talk a bit about your journey as you told it to me in brief, I guess. You grew up in Minnesota, right? And you're the child, second or third generation of German immigrants. Is that right?
Well, yes. My mother came over from Germany and my grandparents did, yes. So so I guess that makes me first generation. I believe that's how it works.
Yeah, I think so.
Yes. And I grew up in rural Minnesota. I mean, I sought out the movement from as young as I can remember. And I got actively involved about 17, 18, late in high school, like about 11th grade, I was already starting to try to recruit. And I didn't really meet a lot of the members or anything like that until after I was 18, 19.
Mm-hmm. And I remember that you'd gone to Germany a few times as like a teenager and stuff. Mm-hmm. And so you had a connection with your history there. And also that, you know, you were pretty independent very young, like you worked and left home at 16. But why would you say that you sought out the movement? You were interested in that history, obviously, when you were a younger kid. But do you have any other thoughts about that?
Well, my grandfather and my great uncles fought in the Third Reich, and that's something, as I mentioned in the previous conversation, you know, that's something that publicly I had not talked about at all, because some of them were still living, and now. You know, those relatives have passed on, so it's a little bit easier to talk about. There was all kinds of white power type organizations. And what always attracted me was the German National Socialism. And that's why I got involved with the National Socialist Movement, because it was the closest thing to German National Socialism, except with an American spin. So I think the fascination started, why it started so young with me, because I started looking at, you know, World War II stuff as young as fourth grade, you know, fifth grade elementary school. But I say that my family certainly did not encourage it, and they certainly did not promote it. At that age, it was just like curiosity. But it developed into much more than a curiosity, obviously, and unfortunately, you know. And later on in life, you know, even my grandfather, you know, did try to discourage me with it, and he approached me at one point some years back when I was an adult, and he said, you know, the path that you're on is going to lead to either prison or death, you know. And I my response to him wasn't very, very kind at the time. It's not something that I never misspoke to my grandparents, except for that one time I said something I kind of regret to this day.
Okay. Daryl, you told me about your upbringing. Your father was involved with the military, and so you lived all over the world.
He was involved with the U.S. Foreign Service.
Oh, yes, the Foreign Service, yeah. And as a kid, you did live in various continents, right, in international schools, and you didn't have the experience of racism as it was here, as it manifested in the United States, until, if you want to kind of retell that story, I just thought it was a very sort of clear moment of when you became galvanized to do what you do now.
Sure. You know, my parents were U.S. Embassy, State Department. So, you know, we would be assigned to various countries abroad for 2 years. And then after the 2 years, come back home here to the States for a few months or maybe even a year, and then get reassigned to another country. And this started at the age of three for me in 1961. And I lived on the continents of Africa and Europe and visited Asia and South America. Traveling with my parents as a child, combined with my travels now as an adult professional musician, performing around the world, things like that, I've been now in a total of 57 different countries on six continents. And so at that early age, you know, being exposed to cultures from all over the world, you know, helped shape who I became. Because overseas, in the 1960s, when I was in class as a little kid in elementary school, my classmates were from Nigeria, Italy, Japan, Germany, France, Sweden, Australia. Anybody who had an embassy in those countries, all of their kids, we all went to the same school. So if you were to open up my classroom door and stick your head in and look, you would say, you know, this looks like a United Nations of little kids. Because that's exactly what it was. And when I would return home back here to my own country, after the 2-year period, I would be either in all black schools or black and white schools, meaning the still segregated or the newly integrated schools. And there would not be the amount of diversity in the classroom that I had overseas. That multicultural scenario overseas had about 12 years to come to this country. So when I was living overseas, I was literally living about 12 years into the future. So when that diversity, multicultural thing finally came over here, like today, you walk into a classroom, people from all over. When it finally came here to the States, I was ready for it. Unfortunately, some of my peers, you know, were not. And so I didn't have the racism experience that a lot of people who lived their whole lives here did. My first experience happened when I was 10 years old. We had just come back from overseas and, we were in Belmont, Massachusetts. And I was one of two black kids in the entire school in fourth grade, age 10, 1968. And all of my, you know, there was a little black girl in second grade and myself in fourth grade. So consequently, all of my friends were white. And many of my guy friends were members of the Cub Scouts. And they invited me to join. So I joined. And we had a march from Lexington to Concord, Massachusetts, to commemorate the ride of Paul Revere. And everybody was cheering and waving at us and yelling, "The British are coming," and all that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. There was a small group of people, spectators, on the sidewalk mixed in with the crowd. A couple kids, a couple adults, who began throwing things at me. Bottles, soda pop cans, rocks, and debris from the street. A couple adults, a couple kids doing this. And having no precedent for this, my first inclination was, oh, those people over there, they don't like the Scouts. You know, that's how naive I was.
Yeah.
You know, I didn't realize that I was the only Scout getting hit until my den mother, my Cub Master, my troop leader all came rushing over and huddled over me with their bodies. Now, these were white people, you know, protecting me and escorting me out of the danger. And I kept asking them, well, why are they hitting me? I didn't say anything. I didn't do anything. Why are they hitting me? And all they would say is, shh, shh, move along, Derek. Hurry, move along, move along. It'll be okay. They never answered my question. Mm. And when I got home, my mother and father, who were not at the parade, you know, they were asking me, you know, how did I fall down and get all scraped up as they were putting Band-Aids and cleaning me up? And I said, you know, I didn't fall down. I told them exactly what had happened. And for the first time in my life, my mom and dad sat me down at the age of 10 and explained to me what racism was. Now, I wasn't stupid, but I was naive. And believe it or not, at the age of 10 in 1968, I had never heard the word racism. I had no clue what they were talking about. And my 10-year-old brain could not wrap itself around the idea that somebody who had never seen me, somebody who had never spoken to me, someone who knew nothing about me would want to inflict pain upon me for no other reason than the color of my skin. It made no sense. So I didn't believe them. And all I had was my mom and dad. I'm an only child. And my parents had never lied to me, never. And on this day, I just knew they were lying to me. I didn't know why they were lying, but they were lying. So I didn't believe them. Well, about a month and a half or so later, that same year, 1968, Martin Luther King was assassinated on April the 4th. And I remembered very clearly, right nearby Boston or Washington, D.C., my hometown, Chicago, Los Angeles, New York, Detroit, Baltimore, Philadelphia, every major city in this country burned to the ground with violence and destruction, all in the name of this word that my parents had used called racism. So now I realize my parents had not lied to me. This phenomenon called racism exists, but I didn't know why it existed. And so I formed a question in my mind, which was, how can you hate me when you don't even know me? And for the next 51 years, I've been looking for the answer to that question. I started out by buying books on the Ku Klux Klan, on anti-Semitism, on black supremacy, white supremacy, the Nazis in Germany, the neo-Nazis here in the States, all trying to learn about it, because there were no courses you could take. Nothing like, Race 101. That still doesn't even exist. So I had to self-educate. And then I had the opportunity to meet the head of the American Nazi Party, which was formed about 20 minutes from where I live right now. It was formed in Arlington, Virginia, by a fellow named George Lincoln Rockwell. And just by happenstance, one of Rockwell's daughters was one of my teachers when I was in a junior high school. And now she abhorred her father. She wanted nothing to do with him whatsoever. But George Lincoln Rockwell was murdered by one of his own American Nazis, a guy named John Poulter. And a guy named Matt Cole, who was Lincoln Rockwell's right-hand guy, took over in charge of the American Nazi Party in 1974. And Matt Cole and his right-hand guy, Martin Kerr, came to my high school. They were invited. Now, you could never get away with that today.
No.
But, we're talking about the 1970s. So they came to my high school to give a speech to one of my classes. And that's where I got to meet them. And Matt Cole stood up in front of the classroom espousing all these views of white supremacy. And I was 15. And Matt Cole pointed at me and pointed at another black guy in my class and said, "We're going to ship you back to Africa." And they took his index finger and made a sweeping motion across the room and said, "All you Jews out there are going back to Israel." And I just sat there looking at him. And one of my classmates piped up and said, "Well, what happens if they don't go?" And Matt, and I'll never forget this. Matt Cole said, "They have no choice. If they do not leave voluntarily, they will be exterminated in the upcoming race war." Now, this was the first time I'd ever heard the term race war. And I thought, what is this man talking about? And then he went on to say how your skin color is going to be your uniform and on and on and on. And that pushed me to learn more about this. And I met Matt Cole again and Martin Kerr again 8 years later. And, I was an adult when I met them again, and they remembered me. They remembered me from that school, and we had a conversation.
Mm-hmm.
So that's how it started.
Also, I just want to say I would love it if you sort of just talk to each other as well. So if either of you wants to respond to anything that, you both say, please feel free to do that. Not trying to be too formal. One thing that I find interesting is that you both describe sort of becoming aware of this, I guess, racialism or sort of nationalism in some way or another at the age of 10, in about fourth grade. And I'm curious because, I know that a lot of, like, my brother was very interested in World War II also as a kid. But I'm wondering if, for you, Jeff, if you can remember how it was framed to you or how you sort of envisioned what you read about at that age, what it kind of meant to you then when you were a lot more innocent.
Well, at that very young age, I don't think I really understood, especially all like the racial aspects. I mean, the books I was reading then were stuff you could get like at the library that they had at the school library. It wasn't... it was mostly focused on the military battles and things like that, from what I recall. So that was mostly what I was reading. So it was that fascination. The race aspect, for me, it did not... I grew up in an area where actually the first black person I had even met, besides seeing them on TV, the first black person I'd met was in about the sixth grade, something like that. I remember it very well because it was a wrestling match, and that's the first time I'd ever even seen a black person. That's how isolated the area was that I grew up in. But the racial aspects of the movement didn't come until later. Like, it wasn't like my defining reason for joining.
Right. It was just like battling empires as you were reading about it. I mean, I'm imagining at that age.
Right. So for me, that came in later. And I had somebody ask, well, what can we do to sort of combat some of these different things? And I think there should be some sort of classes, maybe in elementary schools, that teach about multiculturalism, just showing like, here's the history of these countries in Africa. Here's the different history of these countries in Asia. Here's the history of these countries in Europe, and make it fun, you know, for the kids to learn about all these different areas, because I mean, that's something we certainly didn't have. At least in my school, we had nothing like that growing up. And I think that would probably help vanquish some of the stereotypes. So what do you think?
Absolutely. And I see that being done only in one place in this country. And that's in New Jersey, in middle schools in New Jersey, which I think is fantastic. They have a day every May where they bring in about 30 speakers. Some of them are Sudanese, former Sudanese slaves. Some of them are Holocaust survivors. Some of them are Columbine survivors. Some of them are the fire and police from 9/11, or some of those people who survived that, to show these kids the world outside of the confines of their school at an early age. And because
Now that you mentioned that, I think by the time we got into high school, that was like an international festival, but it was mostly focused on like foods from the different which is good too, but I think it should be more than like a day, because I know for me, I felt like school in a lot of ways was boring because we were rehashing some of like the same history lessons every year. So it's like, okay, if you have time in the school system to rehash these same chapters, you know, I mean, they're a little bit different, but it's pretty
Greek
much
and Roman
the same
civilizations
thing.
Over and over and over again.
We talked about that before, you know. Yeah. So it's like take that time and make a class, you know, make a class. So it's not just one day. One day is a start. I think that's great. But that's one of the biggest things, and I think that's where Daryl finds a lot of success. I can't speak for him, but I think it's in those commonalities. It's like when you're in this mindset, like in the movement, and I can speak about this, you shut yourself off to the outside world. And all you know is the small group basically of white people that are around you, and it could go for any race, but in the white power movement, you're just in that echo chamber, you're just in that bubble, and you isolate yourself. Even when you come across people of other races, religions, and ethnicities, you kind of shut yourself off from that. So I think if we break that down at a very early age and show, you know, that everybody has some differences, but we have more in common than we have differences, and when we have the same struggles, we catch it at an early enough age, we'll have a whole lot less of these problems in the future for the next generations coming up.
Amen to that. And to Jeff's point about having things for more than one day, I remember the food, the international food festival, and everybody wear the clothing from their country or whatever. Mm-hmm. I've been saying this for when 2020 rolls around in a few weeks, it'll be 22 years that I've been saying this. And there are people who agree with me and people who vehemently disagree with me. But let me say this, and then I'll tell you why I say it. I say that we need to get rid of Black History Month. And I'm going to tell you why. For the longest time, we needed Black History Month. It was absolutely necessary because we had no Black history being taught. What was being taught was called American history. And for lack of a better word, it may as well have been called white history, because that's what it was. Black contributors, you know, did not make it, you know, into the textbook. And so, and even some white people were being credited with things they did not discover and things they did not invent. We knew it at home because our parents told us, but we did not learn it in school. So we fought and we fought and we fought. And we finally got 1 week, and it was called Negro History Week. And a guy named Carter G. Woodson put it together. So we had 1 week of Black history. And we fought even harder, and we finally ended up with a month. Of course, we ended up with the shortest month of the year, right? February. But 28 days, and every 4 years, we get an extra day. But we accepted February for two reasons. It was the birth month of two of our heroes. Mm-hmm. One was Abraham Lincoln, and the other one was Frederick Douglass. So we accepted February. But then we became complacent, and we stopped fighting. And now it's my opinion that Black History Month has become detrimental. And I'll tell you why. When we had it for the long time, yes, it was necessary. People began to learn things, etc. But here's the problem. As Jeff pointed out, every February, we only learn about a half a dozen Black people. Martin Luther King, Rosa Parks, Harriet Tubman, Booker T. Washington, George Washington Carver, you know, and one or two other ones. By the time we get through half a dozen, oops, you know, February's over. You know, we did our Black thing. Let's move along. You know, and we move on to the next thing. And we do not revisit that Black history until the next year in February. And the next year, it's the same half a dozen Black people. But yet, we study Benjamin Franklin, Alexander Graham Bell, Thomas Edison, you know, on and on and on.
On and on and on, yes.
All year long. So it's constantly being reinforced. You know, you never forget who flew the kite and the lightning hit the key. You know, we all know it's Ben Franklin, all right? But you ask some little kid in June, you say to him, oh, so who was Harriet Tubman? He goes, oh, yeah, I remember her. Yeah, she was that Black lady who refused to give up a seat on the bus. Okay, he's got it confused with Rosa Parks because there's no reinforcement. So now, over time, when you keep telling little Black kids and little white kids about the same half a dozen Black people. Now, I'm not taking anything away from those half a dozen. They're some of the most important people in our history. But when you keep talking about them and only them year after year after year, you are subliminally brainwashing little Black kids and little white kids into believing there was only a handful of Black people in this country that ever did anything. To my point here, we had Barack Obama as the first Black president. If we're going to follow this trend, then that means we can only talk about Obama going forward in the month of February. Black history, right? So, right. But we can talk about Trump and Bush and Clinton all year long. So, you know, we had the Miss America contest. And when I was a kid, only white women were allowed to compete in that contest because they didn't want a white judge judging the beauty of a Black woman. So this gave Black women very low self-esteem because they're being told they're not as good. So what did we do to elevate their self-esteem? We created the Miss Black America beauty pageant to give Black women something to aspire to. And we had our own contests, etc. And that worked. But then over the years, Miss America itself came to its senses and opened its doors to any American female, regardless of their race or ethnicity. And since that time, we've had several Miss Americas who have been Black, starting with Vanessa Williams and Debbie Turner and then some others. So now that Miss America has embraced any American female, we no longer need the Miss Black America pageant. So what I'm saying is, when do we arrive at the point where we no longer need Black History Month? It should be abolished, and all the information that is taught in Black History Month should be incorporated under the umbrella of American history and be taught the year. And same thing with you, Nama. Your month is March. March is Women's History Month. You don't stop being a woman after March any more than I stop being Black after February. So your history should be taught all year long, too, women's history, all year long as well. Asia Pacifica American Month is May. Native American Month is November. You know, these months should all be, you know, throughout the year. That way, nobody is getting any kind of special treatment. Yes, we needed it at one time, but have we not arrived at a point now where we can accept one another and learn about each other other than one festival, one for one day per year?
Right.
Oh, agreed. Agreed. 100%. Yeah.
I also think that that, like, you're talking about an American History Month, and I feel like where we live right now, this country that, you know, obviously we all love for whatever we live here, we're Americans, was a country that was built on all kinds of things, all kinds of bad things and all kinds of things wrong with it. But in principle, these ideas, rather than some kind of a racial or history that goes back hundreds of years and kingdoms the way it does in other countries. And people talk about how tribalism, which we are seeing a lot of now, is an implicit human bias, that people are wired to be tribal, but that the definition of what the tribe is fairly elastic. It changes throughout your life. It can be your gender or your sexual orientation or your race or your religion, or it can be people that are from your city or that, you know, are interested in certain things that you are, do the same thing that you do. And one definition can also be your citizenship as Americans. And if we present American history as this group of Americans, regardless of race, who have accomplished what they've accomplished, I think that might be something that at least gives us something to feel some kind of pride in that identity that doesn't have to be a racist one, you know?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I agree on that. And if I could expand upon that a little bit too, I mean, the moment I believe we as a country stop focusing on race and saying, well, this is what black people have done, this is what white people have done, this is what Asian people have done, and just label it all as people and get away from that, that sort of tribalism where we're looking at, you know, as like, well, this guy, and all of us, I'm sure, have done it. They say, well, this guy over here is black. My Asian friend over here, or my Jewish friend, or my Muslim friend. And we start just looking at all of ourselves as people instead of how to describe them. You know, well, that's that person's of that culture. And just as Daryl was saying, black history and all the other histories should just be combined into history, because otherwise we're further in a way, we're polarizing. You know, we're polarizing, you know, the people in the country by saying, you know, instead of just saying everybody's people and that we're all one, you know, we're saying, well, this is this group of people, this is this group of people. I think if we sort of, and it's not something that's going to happen overnight, but I think if we kind of try to erase that whole idea of separate.
Or at least strengthen some of the commonalities.
And Nama, you mentioned two words, very important, that we need to redefine. You mentioned the word accomplishment, and you mentioned the word pride or proud. Okay. Mm-hmm. We have gotten so far away from the real definition of the term pride or proud. It's the same word, pride and proud. Pride is the feeling that is derived from accomplishment. You are proud of what you accomplish. Pride is the feeling derived from accomplishment. Mm-hmm. Therefore, I cannot say I'm proud to be black, you know, pride, you know, or Jeff cannot say I have white pride. You know, I'm proud to be white. A Jewish person cannot say, I'm proud to be Jewish. You know what? They did not accomplish that. The only reason that a Jewish person is Jewish is because his mother is Jewish. The only reason that I'm black is because my mother and father were black. They accomplished that for me. All right. I can say I am proud of my college degree. I am proud of the book that I wrote. You know, these are accomplishments that I did. Jeff can be proud that he was a commander for 27 years. You can be proud that you're an award-winning journalist or whatever. These are things that you have worked at and that you have accomplished, all right? But we can say, I'm not ashamed of being white, and there should be ashamed of being white. I'm not ashamed of being black. Nobody should be ashamed of being Jewish. But we can't say that we're proud of it because we did not accomplish it. We should respect everybody on the baseline of the fact that they are human beings. I respect someone not because he's white, but because he's a human being. Now, my respect goes up from that baseline level the more I learn about that person and his merits. Oh, this person invented penicillin. Wow, that's pretty heavy. You know, this person, walked on the moon. You know, that's pretty heavy. Or this person, you know, won the 10,000K marathon or whatever. These are accomplishments. And respect goes up based upon somebody's accomplishments. Let's give everybody baseline respect for being a human being. And if they want more than that, show us how you have contributed or what you have done with your life, and that will increase our respect. But just to say, I want respect because I'm black. I want respect because I'm white. I want respect because I'm Jewish is a crock of you-know-what.
Yeah. And yet I think that as reasonable, completely reasonable as this is, and I agree with it, I've always thought that the word was wrong used that way, just not really the right word. Like, you know, you can identify with this particular identity of yours, but to really call it pride when, as you've said, it's not something that you've accomplished, was just kind of like the wrong usage. I think that a lot of people would object to this idea that we shouldn't have pride in that.
When Escape Hate continues.
When we talk about polarization too, one thing that we're dealing with now is in America, there is this real, I guess it's kind of a culture clash between right and left, what were formerly just right and left, becoming really polarized. It's obviously become accentuated over the last few years. But one of the things I wanted to talk about was that one group really is convinced that the other is evil in this country now. Daryl, you've had a lot of experience. As you said, you've been going for 30 years now to protests and organizations, demonstrations like this, with sort of various types of, we could call them kind of extremist social movements. And you managed to break through to a lot of the people. How do you do that?
Basically, I try to meet them first one-on-one. Because, you know, when you're in a group situation, you know, there's strength in numbers and nobody wants to show a weakness. So even if they know that you're right and they may be wrong, or they may be questioning, you know, their own ideology, they're not going to admit to it in a group situation because their fellow comrades, you know, will sense, you know, that they're weak or something. And that goes for everybody on any side. But, you know, when you sit there and talk with somebody one-on-one, and, you know, I frame it not as a debate. You know, that's the wrong word. Yes, yeah. you know, we may debate things in theory. Let's say, you know, I may not agree with what you say, or you may not agree with what I say. So yeah, we're going to argue the point, but we frame it as a conversation. Because as soon as you say the word debate, you know, everybody's dander gets up and everybody's ready to protect themselves and be ready for the attack, you know, and that kind of thing. But you know, when you say, hey, let's just have a conversation and exchange some ideas, you know, then that wall of protection comes down. And people can be more receptive to hearing what you have to say, as long as they think you're receptive to hearing what they have to say. Then each person can participate equally. So that's what I try to do. And I tell you, the most for me, how it works is this. But again, I think it goes back to how I was raised and what I was exposed to as a kid. You know, all these different people from all kinds of different cultures and religions from all over the world. As a child, I saw all this and took it all in. So that helped shape my personality. I will say, perhaps, had I not done the travel that I did as a child and had that exposure, you know, would I be doing this today? Maybe not. Maybe I was away from the KKK, you know, as possible.
Yeah. I wanted to bring that up, and I'm glad that you did, that I think that your backgrounds kind of speak to this idea of something that I talked about in my other podcast. There's a researcher who came on and spoke about this idea of benevolent radicalization, where he wanted to give that term radicalization kind of a neutral, not only a negative sense, because he studied a population group in the UK, he's from Ireland, that met kind of the checklist of demographic factors, including, you know, religious background, criminal history, certain interests and things that went on to become ISIS. And he studied the group that met that list that didn't, but they went on to become humanitarians. There were a lot of the same motivating factors. So I think it's interesting that now you both are activists or humanitarians, as you would want to call it, but you both maybe sort of became radicalized in a way to fight for something to do with matters of identity at a young age. And your background, Daryl, is like you said, it's multicultural. You lived all over the world. You were exposed to different cultures and people. And Jeff's, yours is, you know, you grew up in a small place in the United States, and your travel was to Germany. I think it's interesting that those background factors, obviously, they can have a huge influence in the way that someone's life unfolds.
And even in Germany, you know, Germany has contributed, you know, a multitude, you know, innumerous stuff to the benefit of society. German scientists, on and on and on.
Oh, yeah.
Contributions. And when we say German, we know, you know, such and such came from Germany. But was it a German Jew who created it? Or was it a German Gentile? We don't know. All we know is it's German. And that's how it should be. You know, I mean, it doesn't have to be necessarily multicultural. People can have their culture and identify mm-hmm. with culture and even keep their culture. But the problem comes in when somebody tries to derail somebody else's culture.
Absolutely. And that's just it. I mean, there's nothing wrong with pride in your culture and who you are and where you came from, you know, just like Daryl was saying. But, the moment that next step is taken where it's like my culture is better than yours or anything like that, when that starts coming into play, that's when you start having the polarization, you start having the problems and people get radicalized and steering people clear from that whole type of ideology. When you break it all down and you go, this group of people is better than this group of people, it makes no sense. But when you're in the movement or in a radical organization of any kind, that gets skewed. That gets skewed along the way, and you start thinking that whatever group you're part of is better than everybody else or somehow superior, and it's not accurate. It doesn't make sense for people on the outside looking in. But if one is radicalized and becomes like that,
yeah,
just like Daryl was saying, if he was to approach a group of people in the movement especially, that's a big deal. Nobody wants to look soft or anything mm-hmm. like that in anything that you were doing. You know, I've gotten asked that question quite a bit since I've been out, you know, where I tell my story about, well, I was de-radicalizing for the past few years. And it's, okay, well, why did you say this after this event mm-hmm. in 2018 then? I look at him like, wait a minute, why wouldn't I say that? I was still in the movement. I was playing my part.
Yeah.
I had to say that. As long as you're there and you're in that world, you have to put on a certain face. So if you can get people in one-on-one situations, just like what Daryl said, that's where it works. That's where the humanity comes through, where the guard is let down and they're not feeling like they're having to be on the attack or on the defense. And it's just people talking, and that breaks down that stereotype and it's almost like a curing a sickness.
Mm-hmm.
And when you get into this one-on-one thing, you know, one of the most important things that I learned is that while you are actively learning about someone else, you are at the same time, you are passively teaching them about yourself.
Oh, yeah.
So the mm-hmm. most important thing that you have is your credibility. You know, that is more important than any money, any product, any service that you have, is your credibility. Because the idea is you want to have repeat meetings with this person. You know, you're not going to say something to somebody one time and all of a sudden, you know, their world changes the next day. You know, it's, you know, because it took them a while to get, you know, inundated in this ideology. So it may take them a while to get out of it as well. It's just like, you know, if you put on weight over time, you know,
right.
If you go on a diet, you don't lose it the next day. You lose it over time. So your credibility is very important. And I tell you something, and this goes for anything, you know, whether you're a used car salesman or whatever, you only have one opportunity in life to make a good first impression when you're dealing with somebody. You may have a second or third opportunity to meet them, but you only have one opportunity to make a good first impression with them. And unfortunately, most people will judge you on the first impression you make on them. So if, like, say, for example, Nama, you and I talked, you know, last week or something on our one-on-one interview. if I did not make a good impression on you, you wouldn't be talking to me right now. I don't need to see you, you know?
Right.
So, you know, it's very important that we make, so even if let's say Jeff and I, well, we meet and we're on opposite ends of the spectrum. He believes this, I believe something else. All right. But we meet, and if I make a good impression on him, even though he may not be believing in what I'm saying, at least he'll find me credible. And mm-hmm. I'll say, you know, let's continue this conversation day after tomorrow. He might say, yeah. But if I, you know, but if I did not make an impression upon him, a good one, then he'll say, no, we're done. You know, you had your chance to meet me. We're done. I don't have time for you anymore. And that's that. So, yeah. Just, you know, if you go to buy a car and the salesman, you know, seems credible, chances are you'll buy the car. And if it's a good car, you'll come back 5 years later and buy another car. And you'll tell your friends about that guy. You know, go deal with so-and-so. But if the guy seems kind of shady and not credible, chances are you're not going to spend your money with him, nor are you going to refer your friends to him. So when I deal with people, whether, you know, they're neo-Nazis or KKK or alt-right or the used car salesman or whatever, I want to be credible. I want to be transparent so I can get that repeat visit. So that first impression must be, you know, a good one. And it can't be fake.
Mm-hmm. I think authenticity is certainly a big.
And words, you know, words play a big role too in how we use words. Like, you know, we call, you know, just recently now, we're calling somebody who gets into the white supremacist movement and let's say goes out and does something atrocious, like say Dylann Roof, who walked into this church in South Carolina. Mm-hmm. You know, at first we're saying, oh, you know, this guy has some mental issues, you know. But really, he's become radicalized.
Mm-hmm.
Terrorist. Before, we only used the word radicalized when we were dealing with Middle Easterners or something like that. Now we're beginning to apply it to our own people here in this country.
Mm-hmm.
And when somebody, you know, walks into a synagogue and shoots up the place or does mass murder or whatever, we're beginning to use the word terror now instead of this person was mentally disturbed. You know, they're a terrorist. For example, when you have a group of white people, men especially, who dress in camouflage and go out in the woods and shoot guns and practice survival techniques and tactics and all that kind of stuff, and generally they are anti-government, they're kind of like a paramilitary.
Mm-hmm.
They are and there are a bunch of them out there in Michigan where Jeff lives. They're called militias.
Mm-hmm.
But when you have the same thing with black guys dressing in camouflage and have a bunch of automatic weapons and go shoot guns and practice these same tactics, they're not called militias. They're called militants.
Mm-hmm.
And the word militant has more of a negative connotation than mm-hmm. the word militia.
Yeah, that's, and it's interesting because one thing I'm looking at with the group that I'm working with is when this word radicalized is used sometimes maybe a little carelessly now, and the difference between people like, I think Dylann Roof was someone like this. He wasn't an incel, so I don't know everything about him, but I think he was one of these lone wolf actors, that he wasn't involved in a social organization where he was seeing other people in person or anything and getting that component of it. And rather he became radicalized. However he did it, it was by himself. It was just reading material online. And with incels, there are some of these too, where it almost seems like they might have had intentions to do something like this just out of their resentment and their hatred and their anger toward, you know, a lot of their perceived slights that they'd collected over time. And they found an ideology and kind of claimed it and fused with it and used that as their motivation. And there's a difference between those and people that are involved in a group like that socially. And I don't know what the difference is yet, but it's an interesting one.
What is the link between incels and white supremacy, if there is one?
There isn't really. That's a false claim. Yeah, that's been falsely said by the media a lot, because they use a lot of similar language. Both kind of come out of this 4chan-y internet culture of being deliberately shocking to throw people off. The incels aren't a racist group. They are a male group. And, you know, the Southern Poverty Law Center called them part of the male supremacy groups. But they're kind of different than some of the other ones because they're really young on the aggregate, you know, and for a lot of them, this is just a phase. They're just awkward kind of guys who haven't come into their own yet. And they're not really hateful, but because they've been there, there were one or two that cast sort of, they made great, great stories for the media to run with. And I feel like all the incidents, the actual incidents that have been associated with them are kind of copycats of that first one. There haven't been many, you know, most of them are just kind of awkward, socially awkward.
Now, one thing that, that maybe Jeff can expand upon is, that's not talked about a lot in the media, is the shift that's going to occur in 2042, you know, about 23 years from now, when the population of the U.S. is going to be 50% white and 50% non-white for the first time in the history of this country. I think a lot of people are getting very anxious about that. While there are a lot of people that embrace that, it's just evolution. There's those, you know, who are becoming unhinged. And I think, you know, that's driving a lot of these lone wolves because you see a step up in the recruitment efforts of a lot of these groups, you know, say, hey, you know, come join us. You know, we're going to take our country back. We're going to build that wall. We're going to get rid of all these illegals and so forth and so on. We're going to take our country back. And then these people go and join these groups. And then when it doesn't happen, they figure, well, you know what? If the Klan can't do it, I'll do it myself. And they walk to a black church or to a synagogue or what have you. These are the lone wolves. So I think as you know, as we get closer and closer to 2042, we're going to see more and more of these people become unhinged with that anxiety because they can't handle it. Sort of like, you remember like in 1999, as we got closer and closer, people got anxiety, you know, Y2K, my TV stopped working, you know, my TV's going to blow up, the world's going to end, you know, whatever. I think some people are thinking that's going to happen in 2042, and that's going to be the year of Rahoa or whatever. But what are your thoughts, Jeff?
Well, right, and that's the thing. A lot of these white people that are in the movement, they're feeling marginalized, they're feeling that... and I'm saying this from, this is their perspective. It's not my belief, but, and ever since I've been out, I have to keep repeating that because there's always people that'll say, well, you're saying that you feel this way. No, I'm saying that's the way the movement feels. So
I do want to ask you a bit about that, about this reception that you're having to deal with leaving the movement. So just remind me to ask you.
Right. Absolutely. But no, Daryl's absolutely right. And I do think that when people are feeling that pinch or what they fear, that fear of change or that fear of being marginalized, that fear of, you know, the movement feeds on that. When I was in the movement and the movement as it operates, we would zero in on those types of things. We would zero in on things and say, look, here are the reasons why white people are being marginalized. Here are how we're being persecuted. We would use it. It was almost like a persecution complex, you know, and we would say, I mean, it was getting to the language where we would say, like, hey, the civil rights struggle that the blacks went through in the 1950s and 60s is what we are going through now as white people. And I know from the outside looking in, a lot of people go, what in the world is he talking about? But that's how we twisted it. And when you have any group of people that's starting to feel desperate or starting to feel marginalized in that way, and you can tap into that psychology, mm-hmm. and use that, twist it, turn it, and use it, and then put that focus in those people's heads, you know, not all of them are going to go out and do violent things, but there's people in there that become unhinged, that do crazy things, like, we, you know, you guys were mentioning Dylan Roof. You know, as far as anybody knows, you know, he wasn't really active in groups. He mm-hmm. self-radicalized yeah. on the internet, you know, and decided, hey, I'm going to go do something. There's people all the time, and I can say this from my own experience, being in the movement all those years, and one of the things that greatly concerned me, you know, especially in more recent years, was some of the rhetoric and some of the desperation. You know, you have people that are like, oh, they would say, oh, well, the NSM is always telling us we have to be legal. We, you know, I think, you know, we need to go out and start something, mm-hmm. you know, like they would want to do more. And,
yeah.
And when I say more, I'm not talking about political activism, I'm talking about right. very bad things. You know, they would want to do things like that. So it's not, and I'm not saying that, I'm careful when I speak, but not everyone that is in there is violent sociopaths and psychopaths. And I say the same thing about the left, and I've taken flack for that too, because I'll say, well, there is violent, crazy people on the far left and the Antifa, but they're not all bad and they're not all like that. When I'm talking about these things, I'm specifically talking about the violent ones, mm-hmm. whether it's right, left, in between, yeah. wherever. If you're doing violence and you're doing crazy and illegal things, you're wrong no matter what, and you should be punished for it. But now I'm getting a little bit off topic, but
well, that's all right. There are a couple things I want to ask you about. One, which is propaganda and the way that these groups on either side, and you know, Daryl, you talked a little bit about this when we first spoke, was that you talked about when you met those, I think he was the American Nazi Party, it was called at the time, the leader of that who had spoken at your high school. And when you saw him years later as an adult at some kind of demonstration, that it was just, you said there were like just a dozen of them with him, but yeah. there were thousands of counter protesters.
I've seen him three times.
Okay.
When I saw him and I confronted him, 8 years after high school, he had about a dozen people with him, but nobody knew. It was called a silent rally, unpublicized. Mm-hmm. So they did not dress in their Gestapo stuff and anything like that. So people were like walking by them, not even knowing who they were. I knew who they were. And then later that summer, they had the American Nazi National Recruitment Rally, where they had about 50 of them from all over the country. And then we had, you know, tens of thousands of protesters in D.C.,
right. And that was when you said that you'd seen footage of it later that night, I think, on TV. And you said that
I realized what he was doing.
Yes.
I was there. I was there. Mm-hmm. And I saw the violence. I saw, you know, the police had made a human shield, a circle around the Nazis. and because they had that protection, you know, they flew the swastikas and shouted, you know, Sieg Heil, Heil Hitler, and all this other kind of stuff, taunting the protesters. People came down from New York, Richmond, Baltimore, Philadelphia, all to Washington, D.C., to protest these people. Now, a lot of them, unfortunately, came armed with baseball bats and chains and bricks, mm-hmm. and they tried to break through the police circle, and they couldn't do it. The police, you know, put their shields up and then began firing tear gas at everybody. And I got tear gas just for standing there.
Mm-hmm.
So people began throwing their bricks and rocks over the heads of the police to land on one of the Nazis in the circle. And then the police, you know, started hitting everybody with their sticks and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And turning over police cars and breaking out windows and setting buildings on fire downtown. And so, I'm all tear gassed up. And this tear gas had something called CS gas in it. And CS gas makes you itch. So, you know, your eyes are burning, you're scratching your skin, and you will scratch so much your skin will come off. So I got the heck out of there, went on home, and I'm sitting there watching our, you know, back then it was just NBC, ABC, and CBS. And I'm watching the local NBC affiliate, and there is Matt Cole in the studio, and they're running footage of the riot. And I saw myself walking by, and he's saying, you see, it's the blacks and the Jews who are, doing all this, turning over police cars and attacking people. Any Nazis doing that? You know, this country is being run by ZOG. ZOG is a acronym, Z-O-G, for Zionist Occupied Government. And it was then that I realized what Matt Cole was doing. Matt Cole was a smart guy, except his smarts were being used on the wrong side. You know, he came to Washington, D.C. Well, he lived here. But he had his national recruitment rally here in Washington, D.C., for the American Nazi Party. This was after he did his march on Skokie back way back in the day. Why would he come to Washington, D.C. to recruit American Nazis? D.C. is two-thirds black. There are no black people in D.C. who want to join the American Nazi Party, and no Jews. So why come here? Well, it was a good move on his part because he knew this would happen. This riot would break out, and then he would get official footage. Official meaning CBS, ABC, NBC, legitimate news footage. He would take that footage, go to the Pacific Northwest, and show it to people out there and say, look, you see what's happening in our nation's capital? The blacks and the Jews are taking over. You know, we need to stop this. You know, this is being run by dogs and blah, blah, blah. Come join us. We'll take our country back. So, and it works. It works.
That's exactly how we did it. You know, I mean, I was trained by people that, that were with George Lincoln Rockwell. You know, I was too young, obviously, to have, met him, but the guys that, that I learned from, you know, served with Rockwell. And these are the exact tactics that, that I used in the NSM for years and years too, is, you know, we always, we speaking past tense once again, but and there's the reminder, Nama, but we in the past tense always, you know, we would tell people, we would tell our guys that, you know, in past tense, we would tell the guys, you are not allowed to use any violence at any rally, period, unless you are attacked, and then you have the right to self-defense. So in 27 years of NSM activism, not once, and I'm not saying I've been called out on this one before too, but I'm not saying that NSM members have never gotten in trouble, because there's plenty of that, and there's all kinds of people that have gotten in trouble from the NSM. But in 27 years at rallies and demonstrations, no NSM member was ever arrested for violating the laws at rallies, because we had strict rules and regulations on those, on that type of activity. Now, there's been plenty of fights and things like that at rallies when police lines broke, or when there was no police, or things like that. And every time it was the left that got arrested, because they were the ones that threw the first punches or that attacked first. So we would use that in propaganda, just like Daryl was talking about Matt Cale explaining that. That would be used as propaganda, going, look, we were out here doing a peaceful rally. These violent Antifa or whoever it was we were facing off against at in whatever particular city, you know, they attacked us. They attacked the police quite often, and they were the ones arrested. We are the victims. And that's, you know, that's how we would portray it. And that's how we would effectively recruit. So these people that are going out there thinking, hey, I'm going to punch a Nazi in the face and I'm going to do some good. First of all, that's going to more make the person that gets punched in the face. And I was asked this question not too long ago either, but it's like, has anybody ever left the movement by being punched in the face? You know, and every time I got hit, it just incensed me even more. I just wanted to do even more, you know, and I don't know that one person that's ever left from being punched in the face. In fact, that further radicalizes, or that further brings that person to the point of wanting to vilify those that have attacked them, especially if, you know, you're out there and you're saying you're doing a peaceful protest and you're viciously attacked. It just further, it further pushes those people that are there, even the ones that might be on the fence,
right,
into that movement that they're in. So it's absolutely a terrible tactic, and it does not work, you know, despite what anybody says. It does not work.
Right. It's actually getting the other group to do their, this group's bidding. It's getting, you know, the Antifa members. And I wonder if, you know, something I've noticed is that they get covered rather favorably by media. And I wondered if maybe it's because there is some awareness that they are being provoked, in order for recruitment purposes, but I think that's giving media a little bit too much credit, but it's possible. Because these two groups that are presenting opposite sides, when it gets taken to that level, are actually, they're almost like working for each other, because they're allowing people to recruit and further galvanize into this opposition. What I was going to ask before was, as someone who has left the movement, and we talked a little bit about how leaving these movements is partially so difficult, even if someone sort of de-radicalizes, because it becomes your only support system. And Daryl, I know that you talked about how when people de-radicalize that you've spoken to, you feel responsible to be present for them, because...
Absolutely. Because, I mean, you know, some people, they come from a family that's already in the movement, in the Klan, in the whatever. Others, you know, don't. They come from a perfectly non-racist, normal, functional family. And somehow, you know, they make that turn and go in that other direction. And so now the group that they join, say, you know, the White Knights of Mississippi or whatever, that becomes their family.
Mm-hmm.
They take an oath or a ritual or whatever to belong to that group. And now they leave that group, you know, not retire, but they leave because they no longer believe in the constitution of that group. Mm-hmm. So in other words, they have betrayed that group, because it's a lifetime membership, you know, when you join. And so now they're out there swinging in the wind. They have a stigma with them, because no one says, oh, you know, this is David Duke. No, it's always, this is ex-Klan leader David Duke.
Right.
You know? And being, you know, whether you're a white supremacist or an ex-supremacist, it carries that stigma. And, and people tend to, you know, question you, you know, well, did he really leave? You know, well, why was he that way in the first place? Do I really want to get involved with him? You know, that kind of thing. And so, if they can't go back to their biological family, because the biological family may have disowned them, for joining the group, and they can't go back to the group because they've already betrayed it, what are they left with? They're left with alcohol, they're left with drugs, or they're left with joining some other cult. And so I feel it's very, very important. In fact, it's probably the most important thing is when somebody leaves, to give that person an anchor, give them something, you know, that they can rely on to build their self-esteem and help them transition back into society so that they will be accepted. If I said to you, Nama, you know, I'm an, you know, if you and I are friends, and I go out and I get a speeding ticket or I get a DUI, you know, and I say, well, Nama, I'm an ex-speeder, I'm an ex-drunk driver, you know, you're still going to be my friend.
Yeah.
But if I said, you know, I'm an ex-pedophile, I'm an ex-murderer, I'm an ex-supremacist, you know, you might have, you know, questions.
Right. Jeff, I've seen some of this with you. You would think that the group of other former extremists, people in that community, should be the most welcoming to you, but that hasn't totally been the case.
No, you're right on that. it's really harmful, because for me, you know, I'm pretty hard headed. You know, it's like I put my mind to something, I do it and I stick with it. So there's no chance that I'm going back to the movement. I mean, it's just not gonna, you know, one, you can't once you've openly denounced it. But besides that, you know, there's no, for me, you know, once I made the decision to be in the movement, that's where I was. Now that I've made the decision to be out, I'm out. There's no middle ground. But for a lot of people, I would say for most people, many people, especially if they've been in a long time, it's not that way. And I've seen others where they've come out, and I'm not going to name anybody because I don't do that. I'm not known for dropping names, and I just simply won't. But where they've said like, "Hey, I'm being attacked by these people and those people," or they want me to go to the far left. And this is where I've gotten a lot of criticism too, because I simply, now, like, a lot of people will, because of the polarization in society, a lot of people mm-hmm. be like, "Well, where do you stand politically?"
Right.
For me, I don't mess with politics at all anymore. I don't want nothing to do with it. You know, for some things, it's like, you know, maybe I lean to the left on some things, and maybe I lean to the right on some things, but I'm not taking a stand politically on anything, because I think it's best for me not to, and it's best for the work that I'm doing now not to either, not to continually polarize. Like, I polarized in this country for 27 years. I'm not going to do that anymore.
Right.
So I just want to do good, positive things, and I want to affect positive change where I can. But yes, there's a lot of people. The most common question I've gotten from people that a number of people from the NSM that left when I did or after I did, some before, and not just from my old group, but white nationalists in general, the most common question, and almost every single person that's contacted me to ask has asked, "When I leave, do I have to become Antifa? Do I have to become a communist?" You know, it sounds funny, I think, from the outside looking in. And if one or two or three people ask that, you go, "Well, maybe they're just, you know, they're just thinking that." But no, literally every person that's left, I even had people from Europe asking that question wow. that were, you know, just like, "Hey, you know, I'm thinking about leaving, but I won't join the left." Because if you flip from, say, like someone like myself, you're in the far right, and now all of a sudden you're on the extreme end of the far left, you're cult hopping. That's my opinion.
Yeah.
You're jumping from one type of extremism to another. And we've seen, you know, you see that. And there's some formers that have done that. And, you know, whatever the case is, I'm not going to badmouth anybody. But the fact that to leave the movement, you don't have to join the far left, or to speak out against the movement, you don't have to be there. If that's where you stand, fine, stand there. Just don't be part of the violence or the further polarization. That's fine. But, you know, there's some that believe that when you leave, you have to join that far extreme. Mm-hmm. I've had people from other formers to extreme leftists say things like, and I don't know how heavy we want to get into this, but they've said things like, "Well, if he was really repentant, he would have turned over his whole mailing list, and he would have done this, or he'd snitch on people and all that kind of stuff if he was truly repentant." Well, first of all, I wasn't doing anything illegal. I was not pressured to get out of the movement by anyone or anything. I was at the top of my organization, and I chose to leave because I didn't want to be part of it. Now, in the sense of doing that, you wouldn't turn over your list. The list belonged to the organization. I'm not going to do something that's unethical. And again, even when I was in the movement and when I left, I'm not dropping names. I'm not doing things like that. Those names, those lists belong to the organization. They stayed with the organization.
Yes.
So there's people, and that's just what a leader, I think, in any whether you're, we signed in my old organization, everyone signed non-disclosure agreements. Like if you were working for Apple Computers, you signed non-disclosures. Mm-hmm. That means you did not give out information. That information was protected. So I'm simply following ethical code and the law by not doing these types of things. But there's people on the far left that will see that behavior and go, "Look, he's protecting those guys in his group." Those people hate me. The people in the movement hate me. They see me as a traitor and you know, the worst of the worst, because I'm speaking out against the movement. So what interest of mine would it be to, you know, hide things or protect people or anything like that? I simply just did what was ethical, and what belonged to the organization stayed with the organization. Simple
right.
as that.
So. And also, as you said, just on a human level, I think people begin to sort of visualize this cartoon in their head about what someone on the far right, an extremist, whatever, looks like as some kind of abstraction, and forgetting the fact that, yes, you left this movement, and it's great, and you are speaking out against it, but you were involved with it as a human being with other human beings that you got to know over a long period of time. These are people too. And just because they believe in something that we might find reprehensible doesn't make them not human. And I think that people have been forgetting that lately.
And that's a really good point, that, you know, the humanity of it. And this will sound, I know it sounds funny to some people, but the last few years that I was in the movement, one of the things that pushed me along was I felt like the movement and the people in it were being dehumanized. And now, after leaving, you know, I'm looking back and I'm going, wow, the head of the NSM, the head of the Nazi party, is talking about dehumanization when I spent decades, you know, dehumanizing others. It sounds silly. It sounds ridiculous. But that is one of the bigger recruitment tools that we used, is look at how they're persecuting people that are in the movement. Look at how the system is doing this. Look at how the system is doing that. Or look at how this crime or this sort of thing is you know, happening, and the movement and the people in it were being dehumanized. And I see a lot of that where people say, you know, I'll punch a Nazi in the face, or, you know, that guy should be shot in the head, or, you know, just this vicious, violent type of rhetoric. And there's no response, because society feels like that's okay. So that plays into the whole victimhood mentality that a lot of people in the movement have, and it keeps them there. So now that I'm out and I can see that, you know, hey, we were dehumanizing others. In the movement, we did the same thing. You dehumanize all these people, and it's almost like karma's coming back on them, but they don't see it that way. When I was there, I didn't see it that way. I just felt like we were being dehumanized. Now I see it from both sides, because I'm out and my head is thinking clearly. I can see it. But what the extremists on the other side don't understand is that by dehumanizing those people in it and making them like they're not human beings, and they just deserve death and whatever else, they're not helping get people out of that. They're not helping to break that vicious cycle that's keeping people in there. You know, what we want to do is try to unwork that, because not everybody that's involved is inherently evil, psychopathic killers. There's a lot of normal, regular families and people that are in there that we can get out.
Right. Daryl, as someone who has de-ratted people many times over years and kind of fell into it, I'd say, by a mix of chance and interest and, you know, a calling. Obviously, I mean, I don't even have to ask you what you think about that, about the idea that people can be, you know, hated out of hatefulness, right? Or bullied out of it.
You can compel someone's behavior, but you can't compel what they feel and what they think.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You know, it's like, you know, I can take a baseball bat to somebody and make them, you know, a certain way, but they're not going to like it.
Yeah. Well put.
To Jeff's point, he's faced with a lot of stuff. And you know, he spent 27 years in a group that was us against them, you know, and either you're with us or you're against us. And, you know, and if that's the mantra that you hear over and over again, then obviously when Jeff leaves, he's no longer an individual. he is them.
He's a them, yeah.
He was us, now he's them. You know, he's not an independent thinker who's capable of just being an individual and deciding what he wants to do with his life. He is now them, because he kept using the word echo chamber, and that's exactly right. You know, you keep hearing us and them, us and them. So either you're with us or you're against us. And if you're against us, you're with them. And so he's confronted with that. And then he's confronted with people who, as he pointed out, believe that, you know, he hasn't gone far enough because he's not turning over lists or snitching on other people, et cetera. And then he may even be confronted with people, who are formers who are already out, but they don't want to associate with him. Not that they don't like him, but that he is a reminder of their past, and they want to get away from that. Like, for example, I've never been a drinker. I've known some alcoholics, mm-hmm. you know, many of them, and I've helped people get clean and get straightened out, and I'm their best friend, you know, during that period. But then once they're out, you know, they tend to move on with their life, but they move away. Not that they don't like me, but I am a of their past.
Yeah. It's a good point, because I think there are a lot of similarities in ways between. Well,
what's really important with Jeff is, you know, he said, you know, when he was there, that's who he was, and he's right. And now that he's out, this is who he is.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and he's not going back. I believe him. The fact, listen, this man led that movement for 27 years.
Right.
That is a feat in and of itself. Because in movements like that, you are constantly having to fight to maintain your position, your status. Because there's mm-hmm. always somebody who's trying to dethrone you and take over and do this and do that. And have their own little splinter group and faction, mm-hmm. you know. Mm-hmm. It's a constant battle. Not only are you us fighting them, you're us fighting us.
Mm-hmm.
You
know,
within and things like that. So the fact that he has maintained that command, if you will, for 27 years says something significant. It says that he has a strong fortitude, a strong constitution himself. So when he's out. And he's going in this direction, that's where he's going, and there's no stopping him. And I think, you know, that he will exhibit the same degree of leadership on this side as he exhibited on that side when he's working towards helping people de-radicalize or helping to prevent people from even radicalizing in the first place. You know, he has that ability of leadership. And now it's being put on the on this side to help other people, and I just think that's fantastic.
Yeah, no,
thank you, Daryl. That's really meaningful. I do appreciate that.
Yeah. Okay. Well, this has been really excellent. I want to wrap up in just a bit here. Before I do, I want to ask if there are any last sort of thoughts that either of you wants to bring up, talk about, get out.
Well, Jeff ahead. And I have something going on in 2020. We're going to be doing some lectures together, and I think this is great.
Awesome. Well, we'll definitely be promoting them on this podcast when it launches.
Yeah, and just to expand a little bit on what Daryl was saying, too, about the infighting in the movement, and I think that's a lot of people, I think, on the outside looking in don't realize that, but what he said there is completely true. I mean, the movement is fighting itself constantly. You know, the different groups, you know, a lot of people from the outside would think, well, everybody's working together. They all like each other. No, even in some mm-hmm. of the similar groups, the viciousness and the internal violence, not just the violence that against people, even in your own membership or between different groups, can be incredibly vicious and incredibly volatile. I mean, it's just, I appreciate Daryl pointing that out, because it definitely, anybody that's out there that's listening, you know, to this podcast, you know, that's thinking about getting out, you know, I mean, that's another thing that bothers people that are in there, is some of the infighting and viciousness between the groups or sometimes even within their own groups. So, you know, just get that negativity out of your life. It's not a positive thing to be involved in. It's not helping anybody. You're not helping your country. It's not good for you. It's not good for your family. And I would encourage them to come seek out a better life. And we're here for them. There's a better life out there.
Thank you both so much.
Thank you, Jeff. And I really appreciate it. And you were doing a part, you know, fighting this extremism yourself, Naima, by providing information to people who would hear you and hear these podcasts, you know, who may be even sitting on the fence or even considering joining. So, you know, it's really a great thing, you know, that you've brought us together to share these stories and you're willing to put them out. It's a great thing that Jeff, you know, did not just leave quietly and fade into the woodwork. You know, he's out here working now to try to counter and prevent and de-radicalize people. And, you know, we all are in this together. I've always said that our society can only become one of two things. It can become that which we sit back and let it become, or that which we stand up and make it. So we have to ask ourselves, you know, do I want to sit back and see what my society becomes? Or do I want to stand up and make it become what I want to see? And I'm glad, you know, that we all are on the same page and we are disseminating this to the rest of our country. So thank you both.
Yes. Amen to that.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you again for having us. And thank you, Daryl and Naima. You are making a difference out there. And I'm honored to be working with you both. And you guys both keep up the excellent work in the amazing fields that you're pursuing.
Ditto.
Likewise.
Thank you.
Happy weddings.